Who's here?
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Committee on Judiciary for the Senate. I understand there's by popular demand, special request. We start off with House Bill 2318. I understand we have a representative on board. Beware. Please come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Gil Myers could come up too with me with CLA, I appreciate it. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Representative, we do have counsel here. She'd like to have the first word.
Thank you.
So if you'll hang on this time, just one second here, we'll let her go first.
Oh, we really do things different over here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was there in their committee on Friday. They definitely do things different over here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2318 allows a person arrested for a traffic offense to have their arrest record expunged. There is no amendment and no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement issued. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Good morning. It's good to see you all here Monday morning. I wish every day was a Monday. Okay, let's move on. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. House Bill 2318 comes to you from a joint effort from Gil Myers. Also had submitted a bill that was mirrored that of what 2318 was, and we worked together and moved that bill then through the House Judiciary and to the floor to where we're at today. But basically, you have a written testimony in front of you from me, and I'm just going to kind of go through this quickly with you. It's a pretty simple bill, and I think, Mr. Chair, you're pretty familiar with this whole concept because you were
Senate bill too.
Yeah, that was my understanding. 2318 is a bill that truly rights the wrong, and if this piece of paper, which is the document itself, 2318, could speak, it would say it's about time. It was unanimously supported by the members of the House Judiciary and also passed 60-0 over on the House side. This bill makes an important change to ORS 137.225 that has been lurking in the criminal code unnoticed, doing severe damage to many. And the intent of this bill is to ensure that any record of driving under the influence of intoxicants, DUI, arrest be removed when a complaint is not filed or an individual is found not guilty. And just quickly, just paint a little bit of a picture for you here. Tonight, should your neighbor be arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants, that individual would be offered a breath test. If that breath test came back 0.00 blood alcohol, the policy would be then that a drug recognition expert would be summoned to do further evaluation of a 12-point step concerning that issue. And at that time, the DRE, the drug recognition expert, would take a sample of urine as part of the 12-step. Eventually, an analysis would be conducted of that, and if that analysis came back as zero for any type of evidence present, all that information would be provided to the district attorney's office, and obviously the DA's office, with lack of evidence, would dismiss the case or not file it. Well, what happens as a result of the statute that I mentioned, that record goes onto the driving record, and it stays there. Even if an individual is not convicted, found not guilty, or if it's never been filed by the district attorney's office. What this does is basically take care of that problem and right the wrong, truly. And on the second page of my notes, or on my letter to you, Mr. Chair and members, there are five specific instances that I have learned over the last year and a half as I've been studying this issue that DUII that is on the driving record has prevented a number of issues from occurring for an individual. A life insurance policy was one. Job applications were truly affected. Even to the point where crossing over into Canada, you would be detained. And then college entry consideration as well as lost opportunity for a scholarship. I've heard a number of cases with that. So bottom line on this whole thing, Mr. Chair and members, this bill rights a wrong, and I would urge an aye vote for me.
Thank you. Gil?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It's always a good day when OCDLA can introduce a bill at the beginning of session and realize that a representative has an identical bill that they're promoting as well. We're here in support of 2318. We do think that it's a hole in the expungement statute. It would allow simply for the expungement of arrests that never result in a conviction, and they can not result in convictions for a host of reasons. The district attorney decides not to file, or the district attorney files and then chooses to dismiss, or you go to trial and you're actually acquitted. It would allow for expungement of arrests in that instance, but it would not allow for an expungement of a conviction. If you're convicted, then that would remain on your record. We did have a member who, an attorney from Albany, who had come and testified before the House Judiciary, and he wanted to be here this morning at the very last minute. He could not be here, but he does have clients who got caught up in this, and they did experience the adverse consequences, the adverse impacts that Representative Olson contains on the second page of his letter. So it's impacting citizens out there, and we think that this is the right avenue to correct it.
All right. Questions? I've got a couple I just want to put on the record. Andy, in your presentation, you talked about DOII. I just want to make certain from what Gail said and the way I read this, this is not limited just to driving under the influence of intoxicants arrest. It's any type of citation that is written but is not pursued by prosecuting attorney or that doesn't result in a conviction. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that'd be correct. But again, if you're familiar, I don't know if you have the -1 amendments in front of you or not, but I was just going to share with you that I don't see the need for the -1 amendments. But to get to your question specifically, obviously if somebody's issued a citation for exceeding the maximum speed limit, does not have the severity of what the process had occurred for the DUII statute.
Right.
So,
but there's five majors. You got reckless driving, you got elude, and all of those to me should be included in here. If you actually, I can see where they can have the same impact that you've talked about under the DUII that's not actually pursued, and it's still on the record as an arrest, but they never even went to trial, or let alone go to trial. They didn't get charged with it through the complaint process.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. The other question, I guess, is regarding where you do have someone that goes through the DUII diversion program. I understand here, looking at on page 3,
yes,
line 16, it does, in fact, say that the arrest for the DUII, which results in a dismissal of the charge based on them completing the diversion, would retain itself. The record of the arrest would stay on the record.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. From your background, your knowledge, you know the issue dealing with diversion is obviously completely different from not filing.
Right. And just for the record, one of the reasons that it's appropriate to have that arrest stay on the record is that currently in our state, individuals can go through the diversion program once every 10 years, and it's a counter. And so anyone that looks at their record in the way of a prosecutor looking to see if someone's eligible for DUII, this is one way to ensure that they don't fall within the cracks. So the dash ones, do you know who they came from?
I do not know who those came from. The section C that's identified there, line 2, the dash ones, makes some sense to a degree, but again, you know, why would you want to have that expunged? Because it's not going to occur if I'm arrested for driving under the influence tonight and I fail to take the breath or refuse to take the breath test. That's going to be going on my driver's record, period. If I fail to take the breath test, that also is going to be going on my driving record, regardless of what the outcome is, you know, in the court of law.
So that doesn't make sense to me.
And D, I really don't see the need for that, because I believe the original bill captures all that.
Well, the D looks like it would actually take in violations, not crimes. And I think the issue you have there is that one of the things that we do count are violations as they pertain to a person maybe being a habitual offender. And so I can see where someone could go in and have their
records expunged out, that somehow might interfere with that ability to count. I know this is for arrest. Says charged with.
Well, it doesn't limit to arrest, so it could be
even a conviction could be expunged. At least my quick reading. What we're going to do is let me first see if there's any other questions or comments, and then I'm going to see if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony. But at this point, we're not going to move the bill today, and it's not because it's the bill.
Mm-hmm.
I've taken a position. I want to make certain all of the Senate bills have made it through the process of getting worked up that were due last Tuesday. Get them out before we start clogging the House bills in, because we have enough time for them to get processed and go to the floor. But I will put out a challenge to whoever has the Dash 1 amendments. If they want to come and see the chair and explain why the Dash 1s are being proposed, so be it. If no one comes to voluntarily accept responsibility for them, I guess they weren't really serious about it.
All right. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2318? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing. Andy, thank you for coming over. And so we'll bring this one back after we have an opportunity to clear the decks on the other processing of bills. So with that, yep. So at this point, we're going to go ahead and go back to the top of the agenda. We're going to go to House Bill 2317 and open up a public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2317 came from the House Judiciary Committee and requires Oregon Lottery Commission to notify the state court administrator of any lottery winners who have delinquent accounts, requires notice before releasing any prize greater than $600, prioritizes delinquent child support obligations over delinquent court accounts, and declares emergency effective on passage. There is a revenue statement issued and a fiscal statement issued and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And Bruce and Larry, come on up.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. Thank you for taking the time to consider our House Bill 2317. This is a piece of the Chief Justice's efforts to improve our collections process and add to the revenue stream for general fund. It creates a lottery intercept for court-ordered financial obligations such as restitution and fines. It's similar to a system that is already in place for collecting delinquent child support payments. You'll notice there's a $600 threshold. The reason for that is that lottery winners have to go to lottery to pick up their $600, so that's a good point to start this process. The way we envision the process is the Judicial Department will create a database that lottery can use to compare winners against. If they find a winner that owes a court-ordered financial obligation, they will hold that those winnings for 30 days and notify the department so that the department can begin garnishment proceedings. I think it's important to note that in the event that a lottery winner owes both child support obligations and other court-ordered obligations, the priority goes to the child support. On the House side, there was no opposition from lottery. LRO, Legislative Revenue Office, estimated $330,000 in revenue for the next biennium. Legislative Fiscal Office estimated startup costs of $107,000 for a net gain of $225,000 in the next biennium. Part of the startup costs, about $57,000, are for lottery startup costs. Those will be paid out of the OJD budget because of constitutional issues on how lottery can spend their money. And then we will have about $50,000 in startup costs to get our side of the system working. This bill passed out of House Judiciary without objection and without amendment, and it passed on the House floor 60-0. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good morning, Larry. How are you doing?
Good morning, Chair Pruszynski, committee members. For the record, Larry Nicewinder, Deputy Director, Oregon Lottery. Just here to make a few comments. As Bruce has testified, lottery is neutral on the bill. We did put into the record in House Judiciary a few items that are of note for the record that we'd like to do so today as well. The a bill such as this, with any time you have a sales organization such as the lottery, we have to put on record really that any potential adverse effect on sales or revenue could have a corresponding effect on the available revenue net to the state. So we don't know what sales would do and what purchaser behavior would be, but any effort to collect sometimes has that effect. A 1% sales reduction to our traditional product, which is the product that primarily drives people to the lottery for over 600 prizes, is approximately $1.2 million net to the state per year. So the second notable action really on any collections bill is that customer avoidance actions do occur. I mean, the lottery ticket that you buy and you have to go to the lottery to redeem is a bearer instrument. So those who figure out how the system works can find ways, friends and relatives, to redeem those tickets. So we've seen this happen with child support. We expect that this bill may have a dampening effect on collection efforts should they realize that. We have some identification limitations whenever the lottery is presented with a ticket like this and we're asked to cross-match to the judicial system. We're unable to use a player's social security number to cross-match these two systems to absolutely positively identify them. We can do that for tax collection purposes and child support purposes. However, under federal law, we're prohibited from using the social security number as a cross-match for any other type of thing. So we'll have to come up with some other methodologies to do that. As Bruce had testified, lottery cannot use lottery funds to cover the costs associated with this collection effort, so the upfront costs would be covered by judicial, and then lottery would, in fact, reduce any costs of each transaction from each collection effort so that the lottery doesn't, in fact, use lottery funds to facilitate the collection effort. So we think these things are each are workable in an interagency agreement with the judicial department, and we have verbal confirmation from them that they would work with us very closely to make sure that we would streamline this effort as much as possible, make it as cost-effective and efficient per transaction as we can. If this policy choice is made by the legislature, we will do that. Bruce has already spoke to the fiscal impact of the bill, so I don't think I will repeat any of that. We just have upfront costs associated with setting up the system and then annual costs related to each transaction. If you have any questions for me, I'd be glad to answer them.
All right, thank you. Questions? We want to start with Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm fine with the bill. I'm just curious why it didn't go down to Ways and Means on the House side. Was there testimony on the House side about that? Because you add it up, the fiscal gets up there real quick, and it ought to be integrated into their budget to ensure there's budget authority. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I have no idea. The exact same paperwork was on the other side, and it went out to the floor, and here you've got it.
The only, Chair Brzezinski and committee members, the only insight I would share with that is that it's my understanding that quite a few of the bills are being worked on both sides before they go to Ways and Means so that all the policy considerations are taken care of in the substantive committees before it actually goes to Ways and Means. So I've seen some of that happen with other bills, and I suspect that might be the case with this one as well.
Senator Romanici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the advance payment issue. My first question is whether that issue was raised on the House as well. And the second one is apparently there's a Department of Justice opinion that you referenced and said that you have a copy, but we don't have a copy of that, and I'd be interested in seeing that if you have it. Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Bonamici, I apologize for that. I do have a copy with me. I'll be glad to leave it with your committee staff. I did that on the House side and neglected to bring 25 copies today, but I'll make sure I leave it with you.
Great. Any other questions? All right, the only thing I had, Larry, I wanted to follow up on your third bullet point, talking about the lottery can only use the Social Security number if the Department of Revenue is collecting a tax debt or for child support. Is that, and it looks like per federal law, so the limitation or the exception to the limitation is something that was granted by the through the federal process?
That's my understanding, yes. The federal law specifically there's four different provisions in there that basically relate to the Privacy Act, and we're following those.
Okay. All right. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Larry, I don't play the lottery, so I really haven't run into this, and I never win anything anyway. But having said that, if I were to win $1,000 and have a $1,000 ticket, what information would you collect from me before you paid me?
It's usually all normal identification information, name, address, and if it's for child support purposes. We do collect Social Security numbers on over 600 winners. We just can't share it with others unless it's for tax collection purposes or child support purposes, but we do collect the Social Security number.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Just for my edification, because I don't remember 4 years ago on revenue, when someone gets $100,000, do you pay out the $100,000 to them, or do you take the taxes out and send the taxes to the state and the Fed?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Brookquist, we do collect taxes up front before payment, both state and federal.
Just didn't remember. Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Any other questions, comments? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2317? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on 2317. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on 2269A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2269A?
Yes. 2269A is what I got.
Presumes that an extradition that occurs within 90 days after the date defendant has been delivered to an agent of the state has been conducted with all practicable speed. And there was an amendment in the House side.
All right. So I have three people that are signed up to give testimony. Michael Slauson, why don't you go ahead and come up, and then we have Gilmeyer and Aaron Kirkwood, if you all want to come up as well. And Michael, we'll let you start off as the proponent.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Michael Slauson. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice in the Criminal Justice Division. I'm here to testify in support of 2269A. Under current law, with few exceptions, an in-custody defendant has a statutory right to be brought to trial within 60 days of the person's arrest. When a person is extradited from another state, the 60 days begins once that person enters the state, provided that the extradition was conducted with all practicable speed. The term all practical speed is not defined by current statute. In 2007, the Supreme Court held that a defendant that was extradited in 72 days was not extradited with all practical speed.
It's the latter.
I've actually heard that in a county, Coos County, a judge has held there that in all cases when a defendant is not extradited within 10 days, that's not with all practicable speed. So there's a lot of variance throughout the counties without any direction in the statute about how to proceed. I've consulted extensively with the governor's extradition office, and through those discussions we came up with the statute you have before, the proposed amendment you have before you today. The difference between this one and the original proposal is its original proposal said that any extradition that's conducted would be conducted with all practicable speed, presumptively, if it's done within 180 days. It's now down to 90 days. And all this statute does, or this change does, is to create a presumption brought back into this state within 90 days is presumed to be done with all practicable speed. So in that case, even in a case when somebody is brought back within that time frame, a defendant can still challenge it and say that was not, under this circumstance, done with all practicable speed. The reason why the state so severely needs some direction and some concrete timeline here is because we often like to use the Marshal Service to bring people back into the state. The reasons for that are two. One is cost. It's a lot cheaper to bring back an inmate through the Marshal Service than it is to send one of our officers out to another state and fly the person back. And the other one is safety.
Michael, I just want to put on the record, when you say Marshal, we're talking about the United States Marshals?
That's correct, Chair Brzezinski. Yes, United States Marshals. And it's also a lot safer to bring back a person. It's basically Con Air. You know, they bring them back in a secure environment. So,
Basically not. But the theory is right.
Okay. All right. Gail, did you want to go first?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Pazowski, members of the committee. My name is Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Our position is that House Bill 2269 really is an unnecessary bill. There was the opinion that came out from the Oregon Supreme Court in August of 2007, Corinne Owens versus Bernie Giusto, and I have here the attorney representing the plaintiff in that instance, Corinne Owens, and she will recount for you the factual scenario that resulted in that appellate decision. But what that appellate decision, the Supreme Court ultimately said was 72 days did not constitute, on the facts of that case, all practicable speed. So this bill would, in effect, overrule that decision and make it at least a presumption of within all practicable speed. We think it's hard to really set up a presumption like that. To get extradition to Portland from someone from Clark County certainly would not be conducted with all practicable speed if it took 90 days, I mean, just across the river. It may be different if someone is in Puerto Rico or Dade County down in Florida and there were some other competing needs, who knows. But we just don't think a flat presumption really does work in terms of denoting what is or is not all practicable speed. The other thing we would note about the bill, and then I'll turn this over to Ms. Kirkwood, is that I think it is, on line 15, I think that it's unclear and confusing what it means for the defendant who has been delivered to an agent of the state. It doesn't mean that the defendant actually arrives within the boundary, territorial boundaries of Oregon. It has to do with the defendant could be in some foreign state,
waive
extradition to the state of Oregon, and the question really is when does the clock start to run? When does the 90 days start to run? It's not, as stated in the bill, upon waiver of extradition. It's when that person has been delivered to an agent of the state, but there can be quite a long delay from the waiver of extradition to actually having someone come and pick that person up. So, again, we think that the bill is unnecessary, but we also think that as currently phrased, it's also vague and confusing. With that, I will turn this over to Ms. Erin Kirkwood. She's an attorney in Portland, and she did represent, she was the attorney for Corinne Owens, which resulted in the Oregon Supreme Court case.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I did represent Corinne Owens at the trial level.
Erin, I need you to put your name on the record.
I apologize. Erin Kirkwood, K-I-R-K-W-O-O-D.
Thank you.
I'm a criminal defense attorney in Portland, Oregon. I primarily do indigent defense cases. I represented Corinne Owens at the trial level in her charges, which could be characterized as welfare fraud. She had a boyfriend slash fiance, been somewhat abusive against her, and they've been engaged in welfare fraud. Prior to the charges coming down, she left the state. There was a delay of maybe about 9 months between her initial contact with investigators and when the DA's office decided to issue charges. She left the state. She was unaware of this. She was arrested in Minnesota at a job, as was the male counterpart of this. The children were left in Minnesota. Fortunately, they had friends there the kids could stay with. The family members were all back here. She was arrested on May 2nd and immediately waived extradition on May 3rd. It took until, let's see, you have to undergo TB testing prior to going into the marshal's custody. Appears that wrapped up on May 16th. However, she remained in Minnesota until June 13th. At that point, she was flown to Oklahoma City. She remained in Oklahoma City until July 12th. And then she was flown to, the opinion says Seattle, but actually Tacoma, and then driven from Tacoma to Portland. So the issues in this case, when we were arguing it, was why the route through Oklahoma City. It does not seem like the most direct route from Minnesota to Portland, and obviously it's not. That's because that's the U.S. Marshals hub. And the way that they transport, we had a one of the U.S. Marshals take a stand in the case. The way that they transport state prisoners is they're essentially at the bottom of the list. They have a list of priority for who gets transported, and they do actually, even the Marshals do call it Con Air. And they fly folks around the country. And the reason they go through Oklahoma City is that's the hub. So she was at the bottom of the list because she's a state prisoner and is not a priority to be transported. The male counterpart in this case, I believe, got back into Multnomah County about 3 or 4 weeks earlier. And that's simply because they have different, supposedly males and females are transported separately. It turned out during this case she was transported with the male counterpart, her co-defendant in this case, for a portion of the trip, which would be against their rules. But nonetheless, that's the explanation for why the concern. The other concern I have with the bill, I agree, from Clark County to Multnomah County shouldn't take 90 days. Maybe even from Dade County, it shouldn't take 90 days if you fly someone back. We do fly people back from Las Vegas. I've had clients extradited from Las Vegas, and they fly those people back. The Marshals Service, I believe in this case, charged about $1,100 or $1,200, I think, for this extradition. I'm not sure what it would cost. I've looked at plane tickets lately. Gas prices are cheaper, so the plane tickets have gone down. It may be less expensive to fly someone back now from Minnesota than it would be to use the Marshal Service, even considering that you would have to fly a deputy out and back. The question becomes, when does the person get turned over to an agent of Oregon? And is the federal government during this time an agent of Oregon? I think that's how the bill is currently reading, that the federal government is acting as an agent. Otherwise, once the person, the bill wouldn't change anything otherwise, because once the person gets into the state of Oregon, 60 days starts to run. The remedy in this case was not that the client's case was dismissed. The judge can put on any conditions of release. In this case, she was required to report in regularly. I believe it was by phone. She was under the supervision, I think, at the time it was PSP. These supervision agencies change about every 2 years, but she was under the supervision of a pretrial release agency. She was required to report in. She did report in. At the end of this, she ended up receiving a 3-year sentence, and she turned herself back in for that and is probably currently serving. She should still be serving that sentence, I believe, right now. But it does not mean that a person's case is dismissed. It doesn't mean that they're released simply to the streets to do what they will. They can be put on GPS monitoring. They can be put under house arrest. They simply cannot be housed in a county facility anymore. Are there any questions?
All right. Thank you. Questions for the panel?
I have one for
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Mr. Slauson, I have a question. You mentioned that the Supreme Court opinion dealt with 72 days and that Coos County dealt with 10 days. I wondered where the first 180, now 90 days, came from, just in terms of a number. It seems like it's outside of what you talked about as a range between counties and the Supreme Court.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Bonamici. I discussed this particular change at great length with the governor's extradition officer. When we first discussed it, went through a lot of different revisions, discussing it with her, 180 days was the first choice. In trying to work with our partners, we reduced it down to 90, because the goal here is to have a realistic presumption that allows the defense to still challenge it, but give us enough time so we can bring somebody back. If I can make one point on the interesting point about the case, the Owens case, is that the trial court found it was with all practical speed. It's the Supreme Court that reversed that decision, but unfortunately it was just in a written order, so the Supreme Court didn't give any further guidance as to why 72 days in this particular case was not conducted with all practical speed. So as practitioners, we're sort of left out there. We don't know what that term means. And this is what this is trying to resolve.
All right. So just walking us through this, Michael, if I could just, if we adopt it, the bill as it's currently engrossed, if the U.S. Marshal picked up Ms. Owens in Minnesota on July 1st, they would have 90 days from July 1st to get that individual back to the state. Is that correct?
Chair Brzozowski, that would be a correct interpretation.
That's a presumption, of course, as to
presumption.
Right. And then at that point, whenever they reach the borders or they're within the state, then the 60-day rule is going to kick in.
Chair Brzozowski, that's correct. And that language delivered to an agent of the state is actually borrowed from the Uniform Act of to secure the attendance of witnesses from out of state. And it refers to an officer delivered to an officer of this state. But because we wanted to be able to use the U.S. Marshals Service, we referred to it as an agent in this particular one.
Right. And that's the other part, is that we would see the U.S. Marshal being an agent of the state because they're being directed by the state to take custody or position that individual to bring them back to the state.
Chair Brzozowski, that's correct.
All right. Then the other question I had, and Aaron, this kind of goes to your perspective as to maybe it would be cheaper for, to say, Oregon officials to directly go and get someone to bring them back. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding, normally these processes, there's two officers that are used, not just one. Is that, am I mistaken on that?
Chair Brzozowski, I've just recently done an extradition. That's what we did. But I'd imagine it might vary by department policy with any particular agency.
Okay. I just knew it from another agency that they normally send out to, so I didn't know if there was a rule that required that or if it could be as individual or not. So it seems like whatever state, or let's say whatever entity within the state that's trying to get the person back, whatever their policy is, would dictate how they would proceed.
Chair Brzozowski, there could be something with the governor's policy, and I, if there is, I'm not aware of it.
Right. Senator Boquist.
Chair of Council, because I believe we had an extradition. We had them in here earlier. Don't all these have to be either signed off or go through the governor's extradition office, which we now transferred to somebody else, or we transferred to the governor? I don't remember what we did.
Whatever.
We took state police out and let the governor do it. Now.
Right.
I think they all have, regardless of what county, it has to be coordinated through the governor's office.
I believe that's correct, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Question.
So what's that?
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Are there any circumstances where an individual could be arrested on a warrant from Oregon in another state and then held without release for up to 90 days in that state waiting for extradition?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsett, there are the extradition process and the timelines are a different set of statutes that would govern the amount of time you have to go through that process. So, and it wouldn't be affected by this change. And I don't know off the top of my head without looking back at the extradition timelines for the hearing process precisely what those times are. I could look it up if that'd be helpful.
Yes.
So if someone were charged with a violent crime, could they again be held without release for up to 90 days under this bill, or originally up to 180 days with this bill in another state before they were arrived in Oregon?
Chair Brzozowski, Senator Whitsett, what this bill addresses, I'm going to try my best to answer your question, is once the marshals or an agent of the state picks this person up from that has been either waived extradition or has been extradited, you have 90 days or presumptively to bring them back. What happens prior to that and the hearing set is set by the Uniform Act on Extraditions, and I don't have that off the top of my head to know what all the timelines are for how long that part of it, the extradition process, takes.
Aaron?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, if I might, I think it would allow for the scenario that you're saying. Current bill, if a person fights extradition, all bets are off. Their 60-day rule is gone. And under this bill, if you fight extradition, all bets are off. It can take 6 months, too bad. But if a person waived extradition, I think the time until the marshals then take custody of them, that time would not be included in this bill. So if, for instance, they waive extradition and something happens, who knows? But if something happens to delay the process of the governor's approving extradition, the governor's office approving extradition, you know, if that takes 30 days to happen, that 30 days wouldn't be counted in the 90. So then you'd be up to 120 days to get back. I think it would make more sense that it's from the point at which the person waives extradition, because that is a little more set. You can't just hold somebody in custody for 4 weeks before you allow them to waive extradition. That happens quickly. In this case, it happened within one day. And that's the thing that allows the defendant to take advantage of a 60-day rule or a 90-day rule, is saying, I'm cooperating. And it's a real hard-line rule of when that person, it's in writing, signs the waiver. On the other end, is it when... We don't have anything that says when the 90 days specifically starts. It's when the person's delivered. And I think that's less clear. Is it when they move from a county facility to a federal facility in Multnomah County? We house federal inmates and county inmates together in the facilities. And the feds use our facilities. So I think it's much clearer if it's when the person waives extradition, it's in writing, it's kind of a bright line rule. But in at least when I initially read the bill and it looked at it, I thought, well, that's odd. You don't, the 90 days doesn't start until the person enters the state of Oregon anyway and is delivered to an agent of the state, because that's what it sounds like. An agent of the state, at least when I look at it, looks like an officer, a law enforcement officer, or someone acting at a jail facility who's receiving this person on behalf of the state of Oregon. When I looked at it and a couple of other attorneys just in my office glanced at it, the initial interpretation was not that it was when they were turned over to the marshals.
I guess take issue with that, because my reading of that on line 15, it says agent of this state as compared to an agent in this state. And to me, there's a bright line difference there. The other part I want to go back on, and at least from my experience when I was in the Lane County DA's office on extradition, if a person signs the papers, at least in that court, the court would give the authority so much time to actually get someone to pick them up. And we actually had times where we said, if let's say the state of California did not come in and get this person by this date, they're out. And so I know at least in the local levels, they do make those, let's say, decisions that if someone doesn't act promptly, and usually it's within a 10 days to 14 days for someone to actually come in and grab somebody and take them, that they'll say, you know, that's too much delay, and they'll release them and not hold them on the extradition.
Members of the committee, that's true, but I've also seen many, in many instances, at least in Multnomah County, where those are continued yet again. So you come back on that 10-day provision, you say, well, California still hasn't come, we don't know, we'll set it over 5 days to find out why, and the fifth day you come back again, well, they're coming, they just can't get somebody out yet, and so those are continued, and that's dead time.
Okay. Chair Przanski, if I could respond to that one, really. That's true, and I was trying to find out if it was by statute or by order of the court in the state in which the person is found at the 10 days, the 14 days. But again, this is a presumption. So if you find a case, a situation that's been continued over and over again unreasonably, there's no explanation for that delay, then it wouldn't have been conducted with all practical speed. It still allows the defense in those sort of unique circumstances to raise that issue.
All right, thank you. Senator Dingfelder.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. This issue is not unique just to Oregon, so do you know what other states do they have a defined in statute, and if so, what amount?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dingfelder. This is the 60-day rule here in Oregon. It's a statutory right that we've granted to defendants to be brought to trial within 60 days if they're in custody or they're released. I'm not sure if other states have a similar rule or which states do. And so if they don't have that similar rule, then they wouldn't have this particular issue.
Okay. Is it follow up? Is that something you can look into, at least what Washington and Oregon, or Washington and California, I think would be helpful to see what our neighboring states in Idaho have?
Yeah. Chair Brzozowski, Senator Dingfeld, yes. I'd be happy to look that
up. Inner mountain states
as well. In my thought, I think it should be broader than just what we require for speedy trial of 60 days if someone in custody, but for someone that's being expedited. What is their rule as to that presumption of 90 days? Do they have something that's similar to that? I think that's really more the heart of it as compared to the 60 days, because we know once they're in the state at 60 days. Just getting them here. Any other questions, comments? All right, thank you very much for coming forward. Let me see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2269. Not seeing anyone. We'll close the public hearing on 2269. And yeah, so I'm going to go. So let me apologize to those who are here on 2353. I did not make an announcement at the beginning. I meant to do this. I've taken the position on all House bills right now are not moving forward until I get a clear, a clearance from the staff on judiciary, that the Senate judiciary bills that were pushed out this last week, the paperwork has been worked, and then we're going to actually go into work sessions on the House bills. So it has nothing about any of the bills. I have not put out any of the House bills since last Wednesday, and we'll probably start sometime in the middle of this week or the end of this week once we clear the floors of all the paperwork that needs to be done on the Senate bills. All right. Any other things that we need to go over for today? We're set for 8:30 tomorrow. So we're set for 8:30 tomorrow, and then the other part is that I believe we are not going to have a floor session on Friday. And so if we don't, we will not be scheduling judiciary, but expect the following two Fridays more than likely will be set for hearings, which would be, the 15th and the 23rd, I believe.
The
22nd. I'm still trying to find out from the president's office as to what's going to happen. I believe that's the weekend of Memorial Day. And so I'm not sure exactly what they're going to be doing on that day. All right, so, but I expect the other Friday we more than likely will be wanting to meet. The last thing is that I'll talk to members. What we may want to do, depending on the flow of bills that we have coming in that we need to go through, move our start time to 8 o'clock and preserve our Fridays for other things. All right, with that, we're adjourned till tomorrow.